You're listening to a highlight from the Yishai Fleisher Show on Voice of Israel.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on Voice of Israel, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Last time you were here on Spiritual Cafe, where we review the weekly Torah portion and prepare ourselves for the onslaught of the amazing blessings of the Sabbath, of Shabbat, we left off with the sorcerer and a Moabite prince, a Midian sorcerer, trying to curse the Jews, and that wasn't working out. But guess what? The sorcerer did have a good idea, though. He said, if you want to get the Jews, don't fight them head on. Don't fight them head on at all. The way to really get the Jews is go in, love them too much, and then you'll be able to destroy them. What do I mean? I mean through lasciviousness, through sexual license. If you get the Jews into this thing that they're weak on, you'll be able to destroy them. And indeed, a giant plague came down. 24,000 people were killed in this plague, and also Jews had to start killing Jews in order to stop this this trend. Well, the ultimate sign of that was when a prince from the tribe of Simeon, goes up, takes a Midianite girl, and he publicly begins to have intercourse with her, and she's a princess and he's a prince, and license is being given to everybody, and it's exactly the opposite of the godly ideal. Moses and his cohorts, our great teacher Moses, is broken at that point, seeing the complete rebelliousness, the lack of morality, kind of like some Americans feel right now with the Supreme Court decision about homosexual marriage, that kind of moment. And he's crying, steps up somebody who kind of is in the dugout. You don't expect him to step up. And his name is Pinchas, or Phineas. And he sneakily takes a dagger into the tent where this public act is being performed, and he runs through both the prince and the princess, and kind of shows it off to the children of Israel, and the plague ends. Well, he's considered a zealot. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Ironically and interestingly, he gets a certain kind of covenant with the Lord, the covenant of peace. This man of war, this man of blood, this man of zealotry, ends up getting the covenant of peace. What is this all about? And certainly this has a lot to do with the way we should perceive our situation today, with all the moral questions that abound around us. To answer these tough and challenging questions, we have our very own Rabbi Mike Foyer, who joins us here regularly on Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Yishai. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so Phineas, Pinchas, he is a zealot. And how are we supposed to look at this? I mean, in today's world, even the word zealotry is a negative word. And certainly somebody who's acting like a vigilante and all that seems to be far from the way we as Jews portray to the world that we want to see things acted upon, and so on and so forth. And in other words, it doesn't seem exactly moral, his physical attack on two people who were having consensual and public intercourse in front of the nation. Did he do right? Did he do wrong? How are we supposed to understand zealotry today?
So I think that the best way to engage the lesson or the message which we're meant to derive from this story is to see how the rabbinic mind has treated it through the generations. And there's also, I think, a very deep message that maybe we'll come to at the end, which is embedded in the text of the Torah itself. So first of all, a little bit of the narrative, right? In the introduction, when God says that he's going to praise and give this covenant of peace to Pinchas, he says, why? Right, he says, because kan'o et kinati b'tocham, that whatever zealotry, whatever jealousness, whatever consuming passion that Pinchas feels, it is God's zealotry and God's passion.
Right. So he was zealous for my zealotry. He felt my pain.
And not only that, but there was nothing of himself in it.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't that he felt bad because what he saw he judged to be wrong, or he considered it dangerous or immoral, etc. That had nothing to do with it. It had everything to do with the fact that he had a perfect clarity that this was not what God wanted in the world. Now, that's the first step. And when we look at the rabbinic understanding of the story, I want to pull us all the way down to the legal code, because you may or may not be aware that this story actually makes it into the Shulchan Aruch, into the great
legal code
of the late Middle Ages, right? And they, but it makes it in a somewhat strange fashion. See, there's a law called Din Rodef, that if a person is pursuing another person with the intent to kill them, I'm permitted to kill the pursuer. In fact, not only am I permitted, but I'm required. I'm required to kill the pursuer. So the Shulchan Aruch asks a very interesting question. If someone is a zealot who is pursuing another Jew to kill them because they've transgressed this ultimate moral code, am I allowed to kill the zealot? Meaning, in that moment, can I be perfectly confident that someone in our world is consumed with God's jealousy? Or do I have to be in doubt and assume that there's some admixture of themselves in there, in which case it's completely forbidden for them to act in this fashion, and my obligation is to kill the zealot to prevent them from doing this act? And that's the way it's codified in law, I think, because already...
And what's the answer?
The answer is I'm permitted.
That what?
I'm permitted to stop the zealot by taking their life. That
even though the zealot is working for a mitzvah, ostensibly for a godly,
even if on the surface of it, the person whom they're attempting to kill is clearly doing an act which is wrong, the assumption written into the code is that a person in our world cannot be so clean in their relationship to God, and therefore to take the power of life and death, out of the framework of judgment and the court and the judge, etc., and to take it into one's own hands in an act of vigilantism is completely forbidden. It's not forbidden from a technical act of law because it's still here in the story.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. So then what's the point of the story?
So what's the point of this? So first of all, the point of the story is one should realize that it is possible for a human being to really embrace God's view of the world. But I think that when we want to know really what the point of the story is, I think we need to look at the physical text. Because this notion that Pinchas gets, right, where is it here? He gets Briti Shalom, right? My covenant of peace. Like Shalom in Hebrew is spelled with three consonants and one vowel, right? There's a Shin, a Lamed, there's a Vav, which is normally a straight line up and down with a hook at the top. And the only place in the entire Bible where that vav is broken is here in the middle of this word shalom. It's called a vav ketia. In the traditional Masoretic text, it's written as a yud, which is a hook with a gap and then a dash below it. And I think that the message is somewhat obvious. I mean, he gets this covenant of peace because in that moment, he stayed God's anger. He did. He was totally consumed by what was right. But there's something broken in his relationship from then on. Because, of course, we know that, according to the rabbis, Pinchas never dies. Because who does he become in the future?
He becomes Elijah the prophet.
He becomes Elijah the prophet, who himself never dies. But Elijah the prophet is taken away in the fiery chariot. Why?
Because he's too zealous.
He's too zealous.
Too zealous.
And he doesn't understand what it really means to struggle with the difficulties of life. And so God takes him away.
Well, he doesn't accept like good enough. It's not good enough. It's like the Jews are he's never kind of satisfied Elijah. He's never.
And what are the two things, the two places that Elijah always appears in Jewish tradition? He at every
circumcision.
Right, and when?
At the Pesach Seder.
Right, which are the personal covenant and the national covenant.
That's right.
Because what Elijah says to God is that they've been worshiping foreign gods, and God says, yeah, that's true. And they've been doing all these kinds of terrible things. God says, yeah, that's true. Yeah. And they've nullified your covenant. God says, whoa, that's not true. And I'm going to prove it to you. Because now for the rest of time, until the Messiah comes, and let it be soon, let it be now, the children of Israel are actually able to be whole with that covenant. There's shalom. There's wholeness. There's peace with that covenant. Elijah will be there to see that every individual is still in that covenant, because a covenant is a relationship, and a relationship is never really whole because it's dynamic. It's responsive to the reality of who we are. The zealot ceases to be a human being in that moment and becomes the hand of God. Well, that's great. Who doesn't want to see the hand of God in the world? But you better be darn sure, because otherwise all you're doing is breaking and you're not fixing.
But Elijah does manage to do that. And in a sense, he continues to be God's emissary in the world. And in Jewish tradition, he keeps on popping up. Yes, he pops up in these the Pesach table, the Seder table, and at the covenant, the circumcision ceremony. But he also, throughout history, has come down and has taught great rabbis.
Absolutely.
And is a kind of a revealer.
Well, the Zohar, the great book of Jewish mysticism, says that Elijah is poshet velovesh. He's able to strip off form and to enclothe himself in form, which the later Hasidic masters say, you know what that means? That anyone who is in the right time and the right place to bring any spark of redemption is, in that moment, Elijah. Why? Because his task is to fix the brokenness of the covenant. If I'm able to give a hungry person a dollar on the street, and that's the difference between life and death, if I'm able to say a kind word to someone who's brokenhearted, if I'm able to make peace between two friends, in that moment, I'm Elijah, because I'm making one more connection on the way to redemption.
The Minister of Religious Affairs here in Israel has recently made a statement about Reformed Jews, not calling them not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was an extremely zealous statement.
Yes.
One could say that there was like a moment of zealousness there.
Yes.
There might be some reason to believe that some Reformed Jews are indeed not Jewish. I taught at Reformed Temple, and a good chunk of the kids in my room were children of non-Jewish women, and so on and so forth.
This is a perfect example, though. If you want to take a legal and analytical look, I unfortunately, it pains me to say it, but I absolutely agree with you. It's been 100 years since the Reform Movement abandoned traditional Jewish marriage and divorce. And it's been, I don't know, 20 or 30 years since they embraced patrilineal descent, which is against the mainstream of halakha. So there are some very deep questions in whether the average person who calls himself a Reformed Jew meets the standard legal definitions of Jew. That, okay, fine. But this is a great example, because why did Rav Atiyah make what is a clearly inflammatory and hurtful statement? I got one word for you. Politics. Because he stands to gain from the furor and the excitement, the clarifying of his position, the making of waves, his own community,
notoriety,
backs, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, well, once you have that significant of an admixture of self in such a statement, one ought to say that it shouldn't have been made. The Ramchal teaches us that there are four steps you should go through before you ever open your mouth. Ask yourself, is it true? Right? Is it necessary? Is it kind? And then wait for a moment, right? I think that if he had gone...
Oh, the wait is the final step?
Yeah. You know? And
I think the last one is a kind. That is a missing component, certainly, I see in the world.
Yeah, and by the way, it's not always each one is necessary. I mean, truth is critical, but even that, there are situations where we see it necessary to bend the truth in order to avoid embarrassing another person or to make peace between people. I mean, it's not the ultimate value,
right?
But yeah, there has to be a question of what kind of world am I trying to build? And that's the question. So Pinchas killed these two people, and he clearly did what was right in the moment, because he stays God's wrath, right? At the same time, walking away from that, imagine what all the Israelites felt. You know, the people that loved, the people that were swept up in their passion, they're walking away saying, this is a relationship to God. I'm scared. Okay, I'm going to keep the line. But God doesn't want us to be afraid.
But on the other hand, though, there's this kind of tikkun olam, liberal tendency amongst Jews that basically... is extremely anemic towards standing up to immorality or saying anything against it. And I see that it goes kind of the other way, where this Torah portion is erased as an idea. It's just totally erased.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody wants to say no.
Well, that was the language of the Supreme Court decision. Love rules.
Love rules.
Right. And that's all well and good. And by the way, it's a very deeply Christian expression as far as I understand Christianity. And there's a lot of nobility in that. Who doesn't feel good about the idea of love rules?
I would just offer up to you that the three Jewish judges that were on that court, mm-hmm. on that panel, and three of them, of course, on the liberal end of things, I'm not so sure that this was a Christian decision as much as one that was strongly rooted in Jewish.
I'm not speaking about the decision. I'm speaking about the idea that love rules.
Right.
I have Christian friends who are deeply Christian, and I don't envy them in that attempt to actually live a life of pure love. It is not simple, because what the Torah teaches us is that in order to have real love, you have to have boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's often missed that without separation, there can be no relationship. If I can't define the line between me and you, I can't relate to you. I mean, I don't have a relationship with my foot. Right? It's part of me. And when the lines begin to blur between me and someone I love, that's not a healthy relationship. And in many ways, what Pinchas did was lay down a line. Does that hurt? Yeah, sometimes it does. Right? Is it always going to make sense? Well, no, because there's two battles going on. And this is important. I really want to tell you this, right? Is that we have to remember when we're fighting these battles that there are two struggles that are occurring. The first one is with people who disagree where the lines are. And these are the people that we need to be in deep conversation with, because the reality is that I'm not always right. You're not always right. Historically speaking, the rabbis were more than willing to engage the question of where the line goes. That's fine. The other group of people are the ones who deny that there's a place for lines at all. And they are the ones with whom we are going to have a struggle to the bitter end. Because you are correct. I think it's a deep misunderstanding of how it is that you actually build healthy life. Life without boundaries, you're a parent. Ask yourself, would your children be happy if you didn't give them boundaries? No, they would be for one afternoon. And forget what would happen to the environment around them.
Sure. Boundarylessness is destructive, and the flood, which, by the way, was the original rainbow, was the sign of kind of, it was a tit for tat, and it was kind of karmic event in that if you don't have boundaries, I too, or the water too, or nature shall cease to have boundaries as well. We're talking with Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe, deep issues of morality, of zealotry, of right and wrong, and of peace between mankind. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
One of my favorite places in Israel is the Shuk. That's where you can find the best deals on fruits and vegetables. And I'm a girl that loves deals. Well, get ready for this one, because we have a brand new Voice of Israel website. Subscribe now to access our premium content and full versions of shows, including The Big Falafel with Molly Livingstone, and hosts like Judy Balint, Jeremy Gimpel, and so many more. Register now for special subscription offers at voiceofisrael.com, and I'm telling you, you are going to like the deals you see.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, and we're on Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer, who joins us here every week to get ready for Shabbat, and he is the educational director of Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. Rabbi, welcome back.
Thanks.
So this week's Torah portion, we've been dealing with some very unpleasant intra-Jewish fighting, right? We've been dealing with public procreation. It wasn't really procreation, but sexual activity. We've been dealing with the spies. We were dealing with negative slander against Moses. We were dealing with the leadership, a coup d'etat challenge against Moses. We've been dealing with a lot of things, and we haven't heard a lot of, like, you Jews are awesome. And we haven't had that, but you know what? In this Torah portion, and we are in the book of Numbers, the Torah portion of Pinchas, there is a group of ladies. They're five in number. They're the daughters of Tzlafchad, and they're from the tribe of Menasheh. This is one of the tribes of the children of Joseph, the two children of Joseph, Menasheh and Ephraim, and the tribal children of Joseph. And they were looked upon pretty poorly because they were one of the tribes, as opposed to the tribe of Ephraim, who had a great leader of Yeshua ben Nun, Joshua the son of Nun. The tribal leader of Menasheh was one of the people who sold out the land of Israel, who spoke negatively about the land of Israel, and was consumed in a plague for really defying the will of God and sticking a knife in the kind of patriarchal love of the land of Israel. Menasheh was seen as something negative, and it was not following the Josephian line, which loved the land of Israel. We know that Joseph loved the land of Israel. Here come five daughters from this tribe of Menasheh, and they want more. And the Bible loves stories of Jews who want more connectivity to God, like those who wanted the connectivity to Passover but missed that opportunity and got a chance, second Passover chance. Here's a bunch of ladies who say, hey, our father died in a sin, and he's not with us anymore, but we don't want his share to be lost, his share in the land of Israel. We want to take up his inheritance, but right now, as it stands, women aren't allowed to get inheritance in the land of Israel. Something should be done. And they stand in front of Moses and the kind of court of Moses, and they kind of say, well, we want more. We want a bigger connection. What can be done?
And indeed, they receive it. And there's a beautiful tension in the way the rabbis understood the story. Either the fact that Moshe didn't teach this from the beginning was
teach what?
Teach the fact that women could inherit in the land.
Could
indeed inherit in the land. Right, was a punishment to him for over-asserting himself in a previous situation. Or it says, no, Moshe should have taught this, but God held it back in order that a portion of the Torah be added in the merit of the daughters of Tzlofchad. So either way you look at it, their voice was echoed by God's will, or their voice was echoing God's will. And this teaches me something that's fundamental in our relationship to the land of Israel, which is it's got to be about desire. Without that element of desire, I'm sure you've seen friends and colleagues who've come here with an ideological belief, with a notion of planting the seeds of their family, etc. But if one doesn't feel on some level a passionate desire for the land itself, it's extremely hard to hold.
It's absolutely true. And my good friend Meir Eisman, he's an kind of ultra Orthodox Jew, but with a big Zionist bent and streak. And he cannot stand it when people say, especially ultra Orthodox Jews, says, you know, the land of Israel, we love it, or we yearn for it because we can keep the commandments in it. He's like, would you ever tell your wife, well, you know, I'm married to you because together we can procreate and fulfill the commandments? He's like, no, you got to love the land of Israel. You got to be passionate for it. And there are things that come out of that. But you have to certainly have a yearning for the land itself. And these ladies show that. And they are held up to high esteem as these kind of new characters. They bring a new light, a new generation of that yearning, and kind of a reprieve from all those other negative things that we've seen in so many of these Torah portions. Kind of, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, and they also return positive agency. I mean, in a very simple sense, if you don't ask, you're not going to get. Right? There's a passivity.
So they're Israel, you're saying.
You see, it's funny you say that, but if you think about it, there's a passivity that hovers over the children of Israel from the moment they leave Egypt, really until they cross the Jordan. Right? Because when it came to the Exodus itself, we were literally sheep going behind Moshe. Right? And at Har Sinai, we had one moment of saying, okay, whatever you say, we're going to do it, God. But then we lapsed back into sin fairly quickly. And there's a whole theme, I think, that you can tease out from this political narrative, as you've called it, of the dangers of passivity. And here, like, well, wait a minute. If the rabbis say that God had intended teach this notion that women could inherit in the land all along, then why did it wait until they asked? Well, because I think it's coming to show us is that we're not passive recipients of the Torah or the land. We are active participants into bringing these things into the world. And that's what brings, that's driven by desire, is a willingness to get out there and ask for something which you may not expect to receive. That's what brings newness and good into the world.
And that there is a body of knowledge that has yet to be downloaded.
Yeah.
God says, like, ask.
Yeah.
Try to download it, and maybe there'll be more. And I think we're living in a time of a tremendous influx of knowledge the world, a tremendous, unbelievable influx of knowledge at a pace that never before seen. And it's because, like, God has opened that valve, but then that kind of effort to as you say, tease it out, to pull it down, God says, yeah, sure, I will release even more knowledge, even more blessings into this world. And that's actually the opportunity of this generation. We're living in a generation where it's a generation of opportunity. Only more can be done. The state of Israel can only be bettered and bigger and more successful and more Judaism. And every single person has got to kind of struggle to kind of see if he can draw down even more. You kind of pull on the, you know, get a little bit more milk from the kind of, get a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more information from that big storehouse in the sky.
And I think that the primary challenge is, we see it here with these women, is that the knowledge of the Torah is never abstract. It's always embodied in action. So there are very clear desire for action, for to be able to inherit and inhabit the land, right? That's the challenge we feel today, is that what are we called to embody? How should we act? Ultimately, I believe that what we're seeing is the beginning of the reopening of the gates of prophecy, right? And then when we actually desire that intimacy of relationship with God and we allow it to drive us to action in the world, that those gates will open, just like the prophets themselves promised that, you know, in the next phase of the world that the voice of prophecy would return.
So there's basically another kind of zealot here. The zealot is the one who asks, who yearns for more, not the one who kills. That's one kind. Mm-hmm. But there's the kind that says, I want to inherit it. I want that land. I want more. I want that relationship with you, Moses, and with God above. And I want it even more than it's been given to me so far. I think that's also, by the way, Aliyah, or getting closer to Judaism. That is that yearning for more, for taking that other step.
I think it's beautiful what you're saying, because the zealot has to empty themselves and fill themselves with God, but these daughters of Slochot have to actually fill themselves with their desire for God.
Folks, that's all the time we have here for Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much. Shabbat Shalom. God bless you. God bless you. And thank you so much for coming in every week. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on Voice of Israel. Write me an email, yishai@voiceofisrael.com. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. Stay zealous, because there's a lot to be zealous for. Shabbat Shalom.
Voice of Israel, your source for news and views on everything Israel and the Middle East.